At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Tonight's Colors of the Dark is brought to you by Arrow Films. Arrow Video brings you the very horror and cult that needs a place in your collection. Recent and upcoming releases include Japanese chiller Tomi, Tarson Singh's visually stunning debut feature The Cell, and Alice Sweet Alice, and Don't Torture a Duckling on 4K UHD. Visit Arrow today for all your physical media needs. Shop direct and save. Use code AROWCOLORS25 for 10% off your next order at arrowvideo.com. That is code AROWCOLORS25. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me is Elric Kane. The hills of Los Angeles are burning. It's kind of an edgy night here. Elric, how you doing?
It is edgy. I mean, I'm a little away from those fires, so I'm not seeing it the way you're seeing it. It's a little intense here.
Yeah, I definitely now have it on two sides. So if I look out my windows of my house going one way, I see the Altadena fire, and another way, I now see the Sunset fire.
Well, we were meant to tape last night and we couldn't because the fire started.
I didn't have power last night.
Yeah, the winds were insane yesterday, and it's pretty horrific. I haven't seen anything since living in LA that comes close to what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. My very first year here, which would have been 2012, I remember that there was a bad fire over Sherman Oaks area. Mm. And I remember that one being kind of intense. And then a couple of years after that, the Burbank Hills burned. And that one felt wild because it felt like I was sitting in like a pit of hell because the hills around me were all on fire. But even that was not nearly as scary as what's been going on because of the sheer breadth and size of what's been going on.
It's very, I remember because Santa Clarita had a few, but being on freeways and looking to your left, you're on the street on a freeway and just seeing fire is a very surreal thing. Like you're driving, but there's just actively fires right next to you, like on freeway. I remember that at one point just being like, oh, I don't think this is how it's meant to be. I don't think we're meant to function in this.
It's intense, but we're doing our best and both of us are safe right now and not in danger. If we were, we would not be podcasting. And Ernie, our sound engineer, he's down in Culver City, so he's doing great right now as well. Just we're keeping an eye on some stuff. But
he would keep recording
Elric,
even if the building was on fire, that guy.
I know. Ernie is that dedicated, right? We'd make him. We'd show up and be like, get your butt out here, Ernie. We're leaving. But Elric, you had a whole holiday break and you did not watch a damn thing.
I read a bunch of books, which was great. I was in Mexico and I had 17. So my last film I watched, it wasn't intentional. I watched a film for class and I left class. The next day I got on this plane. I get on the plane and it's one of those planes that doesn't have the damn movies. You have to have a phone to watch a movie. I'm like, I'm not watching a movie on my phone on your stupid plane. Like I hate that. I think it's my least favorite new trend. I cannot stand it. I get it because they save money not having, I love the little screens. I miss the little screens, but I'm not doing it on my phone. So I didn't watch a movie there. And then I get down there and I realize, oh, it's going to be really hard to watch anything because I'm around all these people. And so then at a certain point, I was like, you know, I'm enjoying this detox because I watched 550 movies this year. I was like, that might be too many again. And so I'm like, I'm going to read.
How did you do that? That means that you were watching three a day.
Well, I went to multiple film festivals. So I think that accounts for a couple weekends where I'm watching 20 movies. You know what I mean? Because maybe five or so festivals. And then just my normal, like when I teach, I have days where I show two movies a day. And so there
happens. True. I do too. Now that I'm thinking about it.
This year I want to watch in the four, like the year before I was at like six something. And I purposely, that's what pushed me to the reading thing. It pushed me to the Goodreads to be like, okay, I'm going to read more books this year. So this coming year, I'd like to get more down to like 400 or 350, like a movie a day, basically. If I can get to that. The problem is also having two podcasts, not one. That makes everything unbalanced and makes me unhinged. That's why I'm always losing my mind, because having two means you have to watch that much more stuff. So I love movies. It's just there is a certain balance where you're like, that might be too many. So having 17 days, no media was pretty crazy. Oh, there's a little bit of media, but like just reading books.
I was going to say, you read,
Yeah, no, I
right?
was reading really good books too, and
What did you
including
read?
I read a book called, when I got there, I just started Ghost Written, which is four novellas or five novellas by Ronald Malfi in one book. And so I finished that. Then I read this book we're going to talk about later called Song of Kali, which is one of the best and most disturbing books I've read ever, by Dan Simmons. And it's his first book. I'd heard about it. Multiple friends had been like, if you're into kind of more cosmic ideas, not cosmic in the Lovecraft way, cosmic in a different way, in the unknown way, it's really
Well,
something.
adding that to my
Yeah,
list
it's
right now. What was that called?
Song of Kali, Kali. It's about a guy who goes in search of a missing Indian poet. So he's an American from New York. He's a poet and he's writing for an article. And there's this famous poet there who had disappeared about 10 years before. He was meant to be dead. And then suddenly his writing comes back and he goes to find out what happened to the guy. And it goes very dark, Lovecrafty vibes at times with that, what happened to the writer. It's just a very, very good book.
Well, that just went on my
And then
list.
the other one, my last one I read was the new book by Ronald Malfi, who is our guest later in the show. And we have a really great conversation, probably the guest I most wanted to talk to in this last year, to be honest. So it's called Senseless, which is a really cool, like LA noir serial killer in quote marks, but it's much more complex than that. I think people will dig it. It's I wouldn't say it's his most mainstream, but it has the ability to feel that way. But yeah.
Yeah, I spent the first couple of weeks, I did the same where I was like not watching my regular watch load, which is at least a film a day. I started out playing video games. Like right before the break, I was talking about how much I had been loving Alan Wake 2, which I didn't finish. I finished it over the break. And yeah, it's a fucking banger of an ending. I loved it. But I also got Silent Hill 2, brand new one for PlayStation as well. And so I started playing that. And then I started playing this crazy one called Mouthwashing. It's a video game about a spaceship that is hauling all of this mouthwash intergalactically. It's literally like a tanker truck full of mouthwash. And they, for lack of a better way of putting it, like get shipwrecked and they start drinking the mouthwash and weird shit starts happening. It was just the most absurdest thing, but I fell in love with it. And so I played a lot of horror video games. I played way too much Poppy's Playtime with my kids and went through like all three chapters that they have, or however many we played, two or three. And then I played like Baby in Yellow, like all of the fun little horror games that they play.
You're
So
becoming
yeah,
John Carpenter. You're just playing video games.
I just playing video
No
games
rhythm.
the whole time. No, it was a really nice break to kind of dig in and play. Little Nightmares was another, or Tiny Nightmares. I can't even remember the name, but that was another one that I played a lot during the break. But I did watch some stuff as well. But let's kick off with the one that we both saw,
Big,
which
big
is the
movie.
one that we should have both seen, which is Nosferatu.
Yeah, Robert Eggers. Yeah, this was the only thing that was kind of killing me because I was down in Mexico going, okay, if this opens Christmas Day here, I'm going. And of course, it didn't open while I was there. Though a lot of movies were opening, the big movies. That one did not. And I waited. So when I got back, I think it was January 2nd, I got to see this at the NewBev on 35 millimeter with all their beautiful pre-show. And it's a movie kind of like, you know, he makes movies more like physical objects, more like things that you would collect than they are just story. You know what I mean? Just because of his obsession. So there's a lot to be admired. I mean, I think the way it looks and feels, the design, the color, it's also interesting. I found myself drawn. I want to see it again. It's one of the first movies in a while where I'm like, oh, I really want to see that again. Because like I wasn't as emotionally engaged. There's a coldness to it, especially to the love story that I didn't find as engaging. Now, it's weirdly enough one of the few films where I have heard there's a 3-hour version. And a lot of people I know will write reviews saying, this is a long movie. It's too long, blah, blah, blah. I found it was paced in a way, especially after it gets going, where it felt clipped. Like they got a note saying, you got to speed this up. And I don't think it works for his filmmaking. And so I think that it might be the rare case where a longer movie, like a 3-hour version, might actually feel right pacing wise for him, just for the kind, because it felt like scene, 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 scene. It didn't feel the way stories like this tend to usually kind of play out, and especially his style is a slower style. So I wonder about that. So I'm actually kind of very curious to see, especially if there's some up top, like to like sink us into the relationship before, because he's just Nicholas Hoult's like they're together for 2 minutes and it's like, all right, bye, I have to go visit a count. And you're like, that's not a long time for me to care about these two people. But what I loved about the movie, and I really, is all the stuff that isn't as familiar to the Nosferatu story from the other films, which is like the dark possession qualities, the weird alchemy stuff, the Willem Dafoe character, all of that stuff is new to the films, at least. And I found that stuff to be really, really, really cool and really interesting.
So I had almost the exact same response to you. I did not connect with any of the characters, at least not the way that I have in prior Edgar films, where like, you know, the witch, I'm completely compelled by Thomason, or the lighthouse, Robert Pattinson's character, I would follow, you know, into the depths of hell. This one, I was just not connected to him. And for me, whereas when I look at something like The Witch or The Lighthouse, I feel like they're doing something strategically new, that they're obviously referencing something, yeah, and that they're trying to look like something old, but that what I was being presented with was entirely new, a story I haven't been told before. I did not necessarily feel like that at every point during this. Some of it was very much like, oh, I've heard this story a lot. But that said, like you, I really enjoyed the alchemy, the dark arts, the possession angle. Like, he was doing some cool stuff with it. I mean, we got Dracula Dong. That was kind of fun.
Yeah. And he's quite different build. I heard an interview because I was curious. I was watching going, wow, he's very bulky in this. And we're so used to Nosferatu being a emaciated thing, and this is a very big, almost creature like and he was saying
sweet stash.
Yeah, the stash sweet I actually stash. Think makes total sense, and I'm all for that. Mm-hmm. But the physical size I wasn't really prepared for, and when I was listening to him, and he said, if you listen to the like, if you read up about the kind of Hungarian Transylvanian folklore of the time, they believed he was more like a zombie. It was more like a rotting body that had mm-hmm. come back. So it made sense why he chose that. And he's, you know, the cool thing about Eggers is, even if it doesn't always work for me, he's always going to the source. He's going to try to find details because he's an ex-production designer and he's like so interested in history. So you get a unique, I couldn't make this Nosferatu, right? If I was making Nosferatu, it wouldn't be this, because he's so interested. Like, even the stakes aren't wooden in this movie, they're metal. And he said that stakes in the original stories were metal because the point of them was to, because the person wouldn't die, it would to be to stake them to the ground so they can't get back up. That's what they came. That's what the whole lore came from. And I'm like, okay, that's really interesting. They don't say that in the movie, so you're left a little bit unsure. But hearing him talk about it, it kind of added to it. But everyone's really good in it. And so even if you don't connect to everything emotionally, it's not because Lily Rose Depp isn't giving a great performance. She is. I just am not caring about what she has to go through in the same way I might. And Nicholas Hoult's, I think, very good. And I think it's a really, really good movie. I just am very curious to see a longer version, just to see what it does. And it's very rare for me to want to see the longer version of anything. This is just one of those ones where I started to feel in the middle, like, this is moving real fast suddenly. And it doesn't feel like he makes movies that move fast. You know what I mean? Though, weirdly enough, it's produced by Christopher Columbus, which is pretty amazing, given the guy who made Home Alone produced this movie, which is pretty cool.
And I will say, I was happy. I was going in expecting to just directly kind of be referencing Murnau's Nosferatu the entire time. And he didn't. No. What I saw most was Herzog's Nosferatu.
Yeah, there's probably a bit more of that. Yeah.
And Les Vampires, which is 1915, like all of his, like, you know, framing and how everybody was like super low in the frame. That's all like straight, like French vampires from like early turn of the century shit. Real kind of gothic and heavily stylized. So it felt more like that than I was necessarily reading German expressionism.
Nicholas Holt's journey from when he leaves the thing, goes to the castle, is in the village to the castle, is amongst the best shit I've seen this year. Like mm-hmm. him going into that village and the long take used, and then him, like, the way the count, you can't see the count while he's talking to him. And I thought that stuff was just like, I was like on the edge of my seat and that stuff. And then I think after that, mm-hmm. once it becomes a bit more familiar, but again, this is picking at something that really is special. And the cool thing about a movie is like 20 years from now, it's not going to have aged a second.
Not a bit.
Because his movies are timeless the way he films them. So a lot of respect for this film. So.
So I'm going to take us to another one that was a Christmas film, because technically Nosferatu was a Christmas film. It is actually set on Christmas.
Yeah, that was cool. That was cool.
It was well timed. So I watched U-Log 2. And so I fucking loved Yule Log 1 from last year, which is made by the people who had made unedited footage of a bear and Too Many Cooks, like the Adult Swim guys, who really lean into just this surrealist, absurdist filmmaking style, which I love. It's just one of my favorite things that I can watch in the world. It'll come up later when we're talking about Ronald Malfi, how much I just love absurdism when done well. And so Yule Log was literally about a killer Yule Log, but it had that very absurdist style to it because they were the hands behind all of it. Yule Log 2 is the same kind of absurdism about a killer Yule Log that can float and it's flaming and it tries to kill people. But this takes it a step further. And I would dare say Yule Log 2 is even smarter than Yule Log 1 because in this one, the entire thing is set in a Hallmark film.
That does appeal to me. That actually really does
how
appeal.
They do it.
Because I've thought about stuff like that too, structurally.
Yeah. The character from Yule Log 1 starts driving to try to get away from it. She drives and drives and drives, and she ends up in a Hallmark film. And literally, I mean, like, she's driving, and you think you're in a horror film, and she steps out, and the aspect ratio, you know, it widens vertically, and suddenly the color palette gets brighter. And they play with that aspect ratio the entire time. It's continuously changing depending on what movie she's in at that time. And she's in a town full of, quote, clumsy hunks that she's constantly bumping into. She ends up becoming friends with one of them and has to try to save his Christmas ornament store from big ornament corporate that's trying to take it over. It's literally just they nailed this Hallmark vibe, but then there is this like killer log brutally mowing people down in the town. And it's hilarious. So this
Except I can't watch it for a year. Now I have to wait till Christmas. So.
No, you can watch it now. It's fine. It was
I'm allergic
fun.
To all things Christmas once it's not Christmas. It's like all the it just feels wrong. So but I will watch
you just
them.
Can't do
I
it.
I just can't do it.
No. Well, I will say before I move on, I'll do these as a quick mention. I went back and watched two of the BBC ghost stories.
Oh, the newer ones,
Christmas
right?
Ghost you were stories watching. That I'd never seen. I watched the Tractate Midoth, which is about a creepy library and a librarian looking for kind of like a hidden forbidden document.
That's the one with the really Fulci image, right? Of the Fulci.
Oh, yeah. That like Fulci creature is really, that was a cool, cool creature. Yeah. That's kind of haunting this document within the library. And then I watched The Mezzotint, which is about a guy who buys this old painting, for lack of a better way of putting it. It's a mezzotint, but we'll call it a drawing, and sees it moving. And it's really cool. It's this image. He starts and it's just a picture of a house. It's just an exterior drawing of a house. And then the next day he looks at it and he sees that there's this little human figure hiding in the bushes. And then the next day he looks at it and the thing that was hiding in the bushes has now stepped out and it's getting closer to the house. And he realizes that it's moving. Not only that, but it's trying to break into this house. And so he starts getting obsessed with it and trying to figure out who drew this and whose house is it and why it's moving and nobody believes him. And this one got really cool as well. These were both bangers.
Yeah, I haven't seen that second one. It's annoying because on the good news for people listening or have been listening for a while, almost all the old ones that we've been talking about for years have finally made it to Shudder, which is a big deal because they're so good and they've been hard to see. But there's one from this year. This Christmas
that I hear is great.
Yeah, I hear it's great. And I can't find it.
Told me it was great. It's not. And I even tried doing. I subscribe to BritBox, which is the one on Amazon that like gives you all of the British programming. It's not on that. I even tried downloading a VPN. Because I have had to use them when I've shot internationally before, so I have a VPN ready to go, and I still couldn't get it.
Did you type in BBC Dark Web? Because if you try bbcdarkweb.com.
It just pops right up.
You have to,
it's right there.
To put some Bitcoins on the screen.
I have to buy some crypto and then it's like, it's like right there. So
I have a question. Did you
one drop of blood? I will say really quick, Tractate Midoth and the Mezzotint ones. They're both on Amazon Prime right now. They're not on Shudder, but they're just on general Prime. So you can watch them for not free, but you know, it feels
I'd like to see the ones from the last like decade. Cause I don't think I've seen many of those. I've seen mostly the ones up into the 80s, basically.
Yeah.
Did you watch the Creep Tapes on Shudder yet?
I didn't. Okay. And I hear
I did
it's
finish.
Great.
I did finish. So I had started before we left, and then I just watched the last like three a couple nights ago, and I really like some of them. It's like it's a little hit or miss because it's like you know, it's like each one's just like a little chapter, almost like a short story. There's one with Josh Rubin that I thought was really fun, where he's like a true
Does he
crime.
act in it
Yeah,
or
Josh
direct?
Rubin is no. So Patrick Bryce is directing all of them, the same director as
All of
Creep,
them.
yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
But it
Yeah.
has Josh, so Rubin comes in as a cinematographer who used to make it, who made a really good true crime doc once, and so Duplass is manipulating him, saying, "Here's a body. How'd the body get here? Let's see if you could work it out." And it's just he's fucking with them. I thought those were really fun. The last couple become more about like, who is this Mark Duplass character? And I didn't find that to be as interesting to me because that's not why you watch these. I don't think the more we understand about him, the less interesting the whole thing becomes to me. It's like much more about the guests and the people he invites in. But some of them were really cool. So they're it's good. It's kind of good in small dope because it's only like 23 minutes. So if you're at the end of a long night, just watching one's quite fun. And the character still has some legs. So that, but that's all. Really, I haven't watched a lot of new stuff because I've been readying, purifying my body and my temple that I've dedicated to cinema that's pretty mad at me these days and says maybe you should dedicate it to the gym, but I've dedicated it to cinema and popcorn.
And
popcorn.
popcorn. Well, I will mention, I got a couple others that I will quickly mention since you were talking about Creep Tapes, the series I ended up binging. It's a whole five episodes, so it's a quick dive in. This one came to Netflix over the holiday, Missing You. And it seems it's British TV show that was, or a series, five little episode blurb that was made directly for Netflix. And it feels, when you started, I felt like a lot of horror fans were hesitant because it feels like it's going to be like a lifetimey thriller. And let me just say, no, this has an amazing horror subplot that makes it totally fucking fun and bingeable. The setup is that this girl, she is a detective. A guy that she has been dating for a really long time, he just leaves. Like, she comes home from work one day and he's just gone. All of his shit is gone. She doesn't know how to communicate him. His phone number has been changed. He's just gone. Years later, she is on some type of dating app and he pops up with a completely different name, but she knows it's him. And she reaches out and she's like, "Holy shit, you're alive." And he responds with, "I don't think I can talk to you," and blocks her. But all of a sudden, he starts popping up in all these other areas of her life. And so it sounds like a really creepy Lifetime setup. It has this incredibly horror subplot that you start bouncing back and forth between. It gets super sleazy. It's got a hell of an ending. Plus, it's got Steve Pemberton in it from Inside Number 9 playing one of like these hilariously savory, unsavory horror characters in it. This was fun. Five episodes, super bingeable. I think I watched this over the course of two nights. I was shocked with how much I wanted to just be like, yeah, I'll just keep watching. Like, it was just this joyous bingeableness to it. So that is Missing You, currently on Netflix.
All right.
And I will also say, on the bingeable note, whoever it is, one of our listeners, I think I've actually gotten this from a couple of different listeners now, that messaged me on both Twitter and Blue Sky and told me to watch The Traitors. Holy shit, this has become like my new like guilty pleasure. Traitors, it's a reality show that I would have never watched had somebody not told me, like, oh my God, you will love this. It's not quite horror, but it is a bunch of people who have been gathered at this Scottish castle hosted by Alan Cummings, and they out of like 12 of them, three of them are traitors, and they will murder somebody every night until the group can figure out who they are and why they're murdering people,
Oh,
why they picked these
traitors. Oh, I thought
specific
you meant traitors, like
traitors.
people trading things. And I was like,
No,
what are they trading? And
traitors.
then you said, okay, Well,
No, he
those
always
words are
says
very
it with
close,
like
yeah.
a heavy, heavy Scottish accent
Traitors.
where he's like,
Okay,
the traitors.
got it.
And so, yeah, like, but I will say it's not horror. But as far as if there was ever a reality show made for like horror fans, holy shit, I am enjoying this so much. I've
Okay.
almost made it through the entire like first season in less than a week. So thank you to whatever listeners
All
recommended
right.
that to me. And the last one that I will mention, I watched Sasquatch Sunset. Did you see this one?
No, but I know of it.
Okay, so I don't know
I
how I
don't think it's a
feel
horror
about
film, though.
it.
They're just Sasquatches, right?
They're just Sasquatches. I don't know how I feel about it. It was a weird one for me.
Okay.
So I need you to watch it so we can talk about it. So I'm going to
All right.
hold discussion on that one until after you see Sasquatch Sunset. I also watched The Bloodstained Shadow, which was my Giallo
Oh, we
watch for
saved
this
that
week,
for
but
the deep
we're
cuts
saving that
because
for deep cuts
I'll
because
try to
you've got
watch
to
it.
catch up.
I will say
Okay, so.
We're going to be talking about upcoming horror films we're excited about. I'll tell you one film I am not excited to see this year. It's called The Dead Thing because I've seen it. But I will say the reason I'm bringing it up is because the one thing, one of the awards we won from this, like, it's interesting, weird Italian festival. I can't even remember what it's called. We won Most Original Film. And to me, that was the greatest thing ever because we beat Sasquatch Sunset. I was like, how can I possibly be more original than a movie called Sasquatch Sunset? Even though I haven't seen it. I just thought that was like one of those things where I'll never forget beating a movie about Sasquatches, even though it's a much bigger film. But anyway, yeah.
I'm gonna take that moment to also mention, hey, my second issue of Barstow from Dark Horse Comics came out
Just
today.
enough
And
plugs.
even in the chaos of LA, I went over to the comic book shop in Burbank and I bought a copy because I was like, I really want to buy my own comic book. It felt
Yeah,
cool.
I'll have to look out here if it hasn't sold out yet because it's been a day. Also, like on that front, the only other thing I did want to say is I was very excited because similar kind of thing. The new Rue Morgue that's out right now that has Clive Barker on the cover thing has our first imprint. We've had a bunch of reviews from festivals, but it was really exciting to see a review of the movie. It was a really nice review by Michael Gingold, but it was just cool. And there's something about print that's still so kind of magical. I haven't seen it yet, but we're also going to have a, there's an interview with me and a co-writer Webb in Fangoria. I haven't seen the Fangoria yet, but I know it's coming. So,
There's an article from me in there as well,
yeah,
but yeah, that
it
Dead
should be
Thing
fun.
article, I can't wait to read.
Yeah,
So,
so it'll be fun. But that movie is coming out pretty soon. So I only bring it up because we are talking about five upcoming horror films we're excited about. We're going to be super brief because a lot of these there isn't
super
A lot of
brief.
them, there's not even anything written about. Like a lot of the times, there's like two lines, and it's like I just am intrigued and want to see it.
Totally. Okay. I am going to kick us off with this one that is coming out in just 2 weeks. I cannot wait to see Presence because
Yeah.
Steven Soderbergh doing a ghost film. I'm in. I am totally
And it
in.
looks
I
very
have
oblique.
no
It looks
idea. Yeah.
very much like it's about the
Weird.
spaces and the physical spaces. So it looks almost.
It looks really
Yes,
liminal.
it does. It actually, and I'm
Yes.
very
And it's
curious.
very POV-y. And I was one of those people who really liked the one that he did a couple of years ago. I can't even remember.
Insane. Insane. Yeah, it's
Unsane,
good.
which was like a going insane addiction movie.
Yeah.
And I considered that, and it was a horror film, but that I loved that one because of how weird it was. So I hope he gets weird with Presence. So Presence coming up January 24th.
Yes, I didn't write down the date, but it's coming out in 2 weeks, and I think it's our next guest. I had to, I like again, I'm just going with the ones that I'm like personally, just I'm like, I really want to see that. I don't know anything about Companion. I just know that it has twists. I know it's by the Barbarian producing team. I think at one point Zach Cregger was going to direct this as his follow-up, but instead the writer of it is directing it. So Drew Hancock is both writer and director, and I just see all the stills of what's her name? Sophie Thatcher and Jack Quaid sitting there. So I assumed it was like a dating thing, but then the log line, all that says is a billionaire's death sets off a chain of events for Iris and her friends during a weekend trip to the Lakeside Estate. So from the pictures, I would not have thought that was the write-up. So when I read that, I was even more intrigued because I'm like, okay, I have no clue what this movie is, but I know I'm gonna at least have some surprises. So that is the first one I'm excited about coming out.
My next one coming up that I'm super psyched about also comes out on January 24th. So I've got two like back to back that I can't wait to see. And this one, it's a smaller one, but I am thrilled because of the concept called Rabbit Trap.
Don't know.
And this is it just did its premiere at Sundance. It stars Dev Patel, and it is about a husband and wife musicians and sound technicians who move to this really rural house in the Welsh countryside. And apparently, open up some type of supernatural force through their music. The review that I read described it as Barbarian Sound Studio, but as a folk horror. And I was like, okay, you've hit a lot of my sweet spots right there. So let's do it. Plus, it's set in the 70s. And so it's like this avant-garde musician from the 70s. And so, yeah, it definitely seems like something that I would like. It's a British folk horror,
And Dev
but
Patel's great.
about, yeah. So I love all of that.
My most obvious one on the list, I'll put this here, is The Monkey. I love that Oz was making Long Legs in this, like literally back to back when he was making. They both were finished before Long Legs was even seen. So he obviously was just like working in a vacuum. And this is obviously on a bigger canvas or a canvas that's obviously more mainstream, maybe. Obviously, it's Stephen King's story. I know it's about two twin brothers who find the old monkey toy in the attic, and then people start dying crazy. Other than that, I don't know anything about it. The trailer definitely was intriguing. Interestingly enough, Osgood Perkins looks like he has a major role in the film as an actor, so which he has yet to do in any of his films because he was an actor, obviously, prior to this. So I was very like, that's intriguing. Anyway, I'm all in. I don't want to know anything about it. I just want to see this movie. So The Monkey.
My next one up is in April, and that is Until Dawn from David Sandberg. So we obviously, David Sandberg, he's been on the show. We love him dearly. But I was such a huge fan of this video game. So I am just excited to see what he does with the movie version of it and how it translates from video game to film and what of the original story he uses and what he doesn't. Yeah, I have a real soft spot for that video game. So yeah.
And we've missed him in horror because he's been off doing Shazam movies. So
Shazam, I'm glad we're getting him back.
One that got my intrigue, I'm not sure, it's a little later in the year, called Vicious. It stars Dakota Fanning, and the reason I'm interested is this is the new film by Brian Bertino, Mr. Strangers and Dark and Wicked, and this just sounded intriguing. It is a young woman must spend the night fighting for her existence as she slips down a rabbit hole contained inside a mysterious gift that was left for her by a late night visitor. So again, that's just like enough to intrigue me, and the fact that I like Dakota and Elle Fanning, I like both of them in movies. I always enjoy horror films when they're in there. Just there's some quality to both those actors. So I'm curious, and I like Bertino, so I'm hoping this will be a good one. So, and good title too, Vicious. This is a good title.
So coming up, my fourth one that I am really excited about, Final Destination Bloodlines, which is coming on March 16th. Our friend Craig Perry is back producing another one of the Final Destination films. This one is directed by Zap Lipowski and Adam Stein. And I don't even know that much of what it's about. I don't even think you need to. You know what Final Destination is about. You know what this one's going to be. And I love that they went with the name Bloodlines because it immediately reminds me of Hellraiser. And I'm just going to assume that that's why they picked that one. So yes, Final Destination Bloodlines. I am excited to have some Final Destination back in my life.
And I think it's a new story, like a new reset. It's not continue. And I do think Tony Todd's in it. So that would be
cool. It's Tony Todd's last film. Yeah, I think it's his last one.
There's one that I'm not going to include here because but I think both of us will want to see it because it's but it's probably sci-fi, and that's Flowervale Street is the new David Robert Mitchell one, which is probably about dinosaurs, but no one knows. So I'm not going to include it officially, but throwing it in there. The movie I think I'm most excited to see, I'll put one after it, but the movie I most want to see, I don't know if it'll be horror or just more like a psychological thriller, is called Die, My Love. And this is by one of my favorite working directors, which is, her name is Lynn Ramsey. We need to talk about Kevin. You were never really here. This is a film that has Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson and Nick Nolte. And it's based on a novel. And it's about it says something like where a woman is suffering from postpartum in a kind of country estate and starts to lose her mind, being Jennifer Lawrence. So if it's Jennifer Lawrence doing that, I'm in. Pattinson, I'm in. Nick Nolte, but even better, a friend of the show and good friend of Travis Stevens, Sarah Lynn's in this movie, which is the coolest thing ever. When we found out she was in a Lynn Ramsey film. So, and she's in A Desert coming out this year by our friend, and that's a really good film too. So I'm very excited about whatever that movie is. I love the way Lynn Ramsey makes films. That's a big influence on me. Has been for years.
The last one I will end with is Clown in a Cornfield, which we talked about a couple of shows ago because we had the novelist that's based on, Adam Caesar, was on a few shows ago. This one's directed by Eli Craig, and this is the Tucker and Dale versus Evil guy. Cool. And even the one that he did on Netflix a couple of years ago, Little Evil, I really enjoyed as well. He like really nails that satirical tone. And that is just ripe for the picking in Clown in a Cornfield. Like, everybody hears the title Clown in a Cornfield and assumes that it's going to be kind of cheesy, and it's not. When you actually read the novel, like, the clown is a small part of it. It's what everybody remembers, but there's so much more going on, so I'm really excited to see how that gets translated to screen.
Is that a first streamer?
That I don't even know where that's going. I assume that they were doing a kind of at least a limited theatrical. Yeah, also, I'll say I'm also really excited about Josh Rubin's Heart Eyes coming out on February 7th. That looks
that's
really
my
cool
nemesis
too.
Because they come out a week before. No, it's not. I'm actually very excited that you'll have both of those on Valentine's Day. Ours in that.
This looks like a really knowing Josh Rubin. It's going to be funny.
Well, I think it's Michael Kennedy too. I think he might have written it. So.
It's going to be funny.
Yeah, and
Yeah,
funny
I
and
would
fun.
say so. Yeah, it's going to be funny and fun. Not that yours isn't,
Oh,
a laugh
mine is
riot, but
definitely not. It has some jokes, but it's not a comedy. No, I think it'll be fun to
exactly.
have like a slasher a week out, and then we get Valentine's Day. I think we're the only one actually out on Valentine's. I might be wrong about that. There might be another one. Okay, so it's hard. I mean, obviously, Del Toro's Frankenstein, we all want to see that. But here's something I didn't know. I knew Predator Badlands was coming out, and I was like very excited. Do you know that they've since released something saying that will be one of two Predator movies out this year? So Predator Badlands is coming out, and then they've got like a
Bull.
secret one, yeah, right after it.
Bull. I am so.
So I'm very
Unless they're
excited.
doing one that follows the actual Predator mythos and then another one like Predator Prey, where they're like, okay, now let's zap it into the
I feel one
1800s
of
or
them will have
something.
the girl from the last Predator movie in it, and I don't think it's the Badland ones because that's the same director, and Elle Fanning. So again, another Fanning. But that's not my pick because, and again, the movie I am picking, I have no clue if that's really coming out this year. It was in the list where you read these 50 films coming out. Richard Bachman's The Running Man. Actually,
I saw
yes,
that
The Running.
pop up and it didn't have a final date
No, well,
yet.
it's being put in this year thing, but this is something I heard about a months ago. But it's Edgar Wright. Doing running now. The cool thing about Running Man, I feel like there's a lot of Arnie movies. Definitely. What's the one in space and Mars? Oh my God, my brain. What's the? Yeah,
Total
Total Recall.
Recall.
There's a lot of his movies that were.
I was letting you try to
Yeah.
work it
No, but a
out.
lot of these projects weren't written with someone like Arnie in mind. They were actually changed because of his popularity. So running in the case of the one we were just talking about, that was a David Cronenberg, William Hurt project for a long, long time, and then fell apart, and then it became an Arnie film. So the tone is totally different in Total Recall. Running Man, I can see a totally different movie with the Running Man if it wasn't like Arnie and his obviously comedy satirical action, which it went for. So with Edgar Wright, I'm like, okay, I am so interested in what he could do. And it's got Glenn Powell as a cop who is pulled into this thing, into this game show. So I am like, and also we're in the year of Glenn Powell. So I'm very excited to see what Edgar Wright does with that. So
Okay.
I'm very
We
keen.
have got some great ones coming
Yeah.
this year, hoping that it will be just as much a banger as last year
It
was,
was a
because
very
we
good year.
definitely had a banger year last year. So, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, y'all. So let's bring on a novelist that we have been wanting to talk to for a long time, and we're excited to finally get him. He has a brand new book coming this April. So welcome to the show, Ronald Malfi.
What would you do if your fiance invited you to their bachelor party? Would you go? In Dark Skies Films' newest thriller, Bird Eater, a bride-to-be joins her fiance's bachelor party in the remote Australian outback. As the festivities spiral into beer-soaked chaos, uncomfortable details about their relationship are exposed, turning the celebration into a twisted and shocking nightmare. Variety, IndieWire, and The Daily Beast declare Bird Eater as feral. Bloody Disgusting calls it nail-biting. Nightmare on Film Street says it's a chaotic descent into madness that's both hypnotic and haunting. From Dark Sky Films, it's Bird Eater. See it in theaters on January 10th, and it's available to watch at home on digital on January 17th. And I saw it at a festival, and this is actually a fantastic movie. I saw it right at the end of the year, so I'm a big fan too.
Tonight's Colors of the Dark is also brought to you by Severin Films. Severin Films closed out 2024 with nine of the year's top genre releases, featuring the North American UHD premiere of Delicatessen, a three-disc collection with 6 hours of special features, the worldwide UHD premiere of Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral, a three-disc collection that also includes the Cannes Film Festival cut, the North American UHD premiere of Bruno Mathai's Hell of the Living Dead, and Rats, Night of Terror, both with bonus soundtrack CDs and the all-new novelizations. The worldwide UHD of Aldo Lotto's Night Train Murders, featuring 5 hours of special features plus a bonus CD of Ennio Morricone soundtracks. The Blu-ray premiere of Lamberto Bava's The Mask of Satan, the North American UHD premiere of three Italian cannibal classics, including Umberto Lenzi's Eaten Alive, Sergio Martino's Slave of the Cannibal God, and Ruggero Deodato's Last Cannibal World. All this and much more only at SeverinFilms.com.
Okay, welcome back. I had just been informed by Goodreads that I have read 8 Ronald Malfi books in 2024, and I don't think I've done that with an author's work since I was about 15 years old with Stephen King. When you first discover somebody whose voice just like whatever it is about, it's not so much just stories, it's something about voice. And so it's been very exciting. When Becca told me that we're going to have you on the show, this was something we were like really excited to talk to you. So welcome to the show, Ronald Malfi.
Thank you, and I'm excited to be here. And would you say 8? So you got to double that number for the next year.
How many,
right?
How many have I not read then?
What's, yeah, what's the how number? Many do you have? That's
not
amazing.
Novellas. Don't count novellas if they're in collections. Not, so
just regular novels. I want to say like 20.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've been, according to Wikipedia, the source of all things, you've been doing this since 2000.
My first novel was published in 2000, a year after I graduated college. I didn't want to get a real job, so.
I'm gonna just jump right in. So what was it like getting that first one out? Because that's always the hardest step I've discovered with everybody, myself included. Like that first one was the hardest, and then after that, they kind of flow a little bit more easy.
Some parts of it are hard because you're new. You don't know the industry. You don't really know what's going on. This is back when you still had to buy one of those big writer's market books to find where you're even going to send these things to. But then some things about it are kind of easy because you're so like doe-eyed and innocent going into this. You're like, oh, I can make a living as a writer, not realizing that. No, you're people don't want you to. But that's how I went into it. By the time I graduated college, I had about 6 novel manuscripts written. And I just picked the best one, shopped it around, and it got picked up by a small indie press. And, you know, I like to jokingly say that, you know, I kind of bought my sports coat with the suede patches on the elbows and started smoking a pipe and sitting in front. And I'm like, oh, I've got it made now. I didn't make a dime off of that book. It was just terrible.
What's the title of that one? Just so I know.
Oh, we don't even talk.
Oh, yeah. I want to hear it now. What's the title of Mr. Cables? It's going to be the title of the book in Mr. Cables, right?
That's right. I refer to it as the book that we do not speak of. But no, it was called The Space Between.
Okay.
And I think my hunger for getting published exceeded my talent for being published at the time. But I was always into writing. Like I said, I had about 6 novel manuscripts written by the time I graduated. And man, I was hungry to get into it. And, you know, even though in hindsight, it was a bad book written by a guy who was still learning his craft, published by an operation that probably shouldn't have existed legally, you know, and it just didn't work.
The film professor side of me, we never say bad. There's room for improvement, but it's never bad.
Writer side says it was fucking bad. And I could be profound and say it was an exercise in juvenilia, but it was not. It's one of my books that will probably never be republished. So
how self-aware of that were you once it was published? Like, obviously now with hindsight, it's easy to look at your early work, but like in the moment, how were you feeling?
No, it was mostly in hindsight. I mean, even stuff I've written, you know, just a few years ago where I've always got things going on and I'll set them aside and I'll you know, I'll keep them in a drawer and kind of let them percolate or whatever. When I do revisit them after a few years later, you know, I can see what the problems are and I can see why it wasn't working for me at the time. And I'll say this, the thing I did learn early is, and not necessarily with that first book, but soon after, is even if I don't know what the fix is, I can recognize that there's a problem and have enough wherewithal to set it aside. And I think that was it. Hemingway said that every good writer is born with a built-in bullshit detector. Yeah. And I think that's kind of it. Like you get, I may not know what the fix is in the moment, but I do know if it's garbage and I will set it aside and let it sit for a while and, or maybe forever. I don't know. Until it feels like, you know, fashionable for public consumption, I guess.
Were you equally a big, like as a young person, were you a big reader of dark fiction at a young age, or was
I was a big reader of everything. Yeah. Everything I can get my hands on. I mean, I loved Stephen King, you know, Peter Straub, you know, I mentioned Hemingway. I was a huge Hemingway fan, but I read everything. Didn't matter the genre, didn't even if I was reading a book and knew midway through the book, this book is garbage. I still finished it because one, I was always compelled to finish something I started when I was reading something, and two, I think it benefits you as a writer to even read bad stuff, to know what a bad book reads like. But I did. I read anything I get my hands on. I mean, I remember one time, one summer, I was at my grandparents' house, and they had the box in their rec room of like Reader's Digest condensed novels, or they even had a copy of Nabokov's Lolita, which I think I read at like 14 years old. I didn't even understand it, but I'm like, oh, this is. But I recognize that for a book written in the 50s, it was very modern reading, you know. So it's things that you take away from this stuff, even if you don't fully grasp it at a certain age, fully grasp the book you're reading. You know, I was still able to kind of take away certain parts of it and say, oh, that's interesting for what this is. I always found something to take away from it.
We were lucky not to have
Sometimes.
choices back then, like so many choices. Like if you're in a cabin and there's five books, you're going to read those five books. Now you would go, I'll look up what I want to order and take it with me, and it's much more
You know what? And
convenient.
you're, yeah. Go ahead,
Sometimes
Rebecca.
those have turned out to be some of my most kind of reflective reads, because I remember I was probably ninth grade, maybe 10th, when my mom got like a box of books at a yard sale. My mom was big into yard sales, and she was always picking up this box of novels at yard sales, and she got Still Life with Woodpecker. And I remember reading that. So I was probably in ninth or
That
10th
Tom
grade.
Robbins?
No fucking, yeah, no fucking clue what it was about. I still don't know what it was about. It's like a princess on the cover of the Marlboro, or I think it was like Camel cigarette package. Like I had no clue what was going on, but reading it at that age, it was so shaping of me. Like I still point at that and say, like, is that where my absurdist, like surrealism began? Because I had no idea what I was reading to the point that it was really able to be more impressionable on me. So sometimes those cold reads can be the greatest thing.
Or and cold reads at an age where maybe it's not meant for you because it resonates differently. Maybe if you were older, a book like that wouldn't mean as much, but for whatever reason at that time, it does, you know?
It's
So
fascinating
yeah.
what gets people to read. Like now it's obviously even harder. We all have kids to get somebody to read, you have to find the right in what that could be, a graphic novel or something else. And for me, at the same age you guys were talking about, it was a biography on Larry Bird. And I look back at that and go, weird, but that
Hold
sent me
up.
completely onto a path
Is
of reading.
does he play basketball? Is
Yeah. Oh
that
my
Larry
God. Oh
Bird?
my
Oh,
God.
okay.
Oh
Do
my
I
God.
sound like an idiot?
You're not from French Lick, Indiana. What is wrong with you? But it
I
was
am
like, but it
not.
was highly compelling because they were like, I guess it was his father committed suicide and he was raised in this town and he's this perfectionist. And I was into basketball as a kid, but it was like weird that that is the book. I remember it really well because it had all those dramatic tensions to it that led me to. So it's this, it was something real, like a biography or autobiography. And it is interesting how your taste in years change. Like in my 20s, I read a lot of, things like Camus and things like that. Now I'm not interested to read that.
Nope.
Whereas genre fiction, you're talking about like readability, and I think that's saying about your work that I would comment on, which was like right now I'm reading a Stephen King book that's good, but when I put it down for a few days, I found it really hard to pick up right now, even though he's such a readable. I didn't have that issue with your work. I always found once I started reading it, I was in to the end, really just I was kind of hooked. And I think that maybe is the voice more than the story usually of a writer. I don't know if you how you feel when you are reading, not your own work, but other people's stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I find from other, I've certainly got favorites or people I go to, for me, it's about the readability. It's the language. It's the, Stephen King was always that way for me because he's got su such a, especially, when he was like really firing on all engines, he's got such a chummy, Uncle Steve vibe to his work, right? And like people like a book like It, where everybody's, oh, it's terrifying. I love that book, but I find it very cozy. You know, I don't know. There's something warm about that book to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird,
It's
but.
got like this bucolic side to it, this almost kind of like idyllic small town and this pack of kids on bikes. And I know that that was like cutting edge horror at the time, but as somebody now like you know, 20 years after the fact when I first read it, or 30 even coming up, oh God, I'm old. You know, it now, it embodies the same thing that Stranger Things does for me, where it has this horrific side to it. Yeah, but I look back at it as like, oh, it represents my childhood and my kids on bikes years that I just, you know, I would never let my kids go out on bikes now. That might just be because I live in the middle of LA, but still. Yeah, so it does. It has this weird, fuzzy, warm feeling for me now.
Did any of them ever were too scared? I like when maybe the first one I remember reading was Pet Sematary, and I found that actually scary to read. Like there aren't many after that. Like with movies, it's a little different, but even works out to be the same as you get older. But with books, was there ever anything that you felt at a young age you were?
Pet Sematary was the only book that scared me,
and I don't
remember how old I was when I read it. And it really wasn't the Pet Sematary part; it was the Zelda.
Yeah, Zelda.
Zelda.
Mm-hmm. And I've kind of come to this. Over the years, I've kind of cobbled together the things that I find most frightening in books and in literature when I'm reading it, and I realize that everything I find most frightening is in a book is not a scene that the author is writing. It's a scene that the author is writing about a character telling a story.
Yeah.
And I find that there's something unsettling about that layer where the author isn't showing you. It's sort of like you've got to use your double imagination, you know?
And it's kind of like when an actor in a movie is lying, a character is lying, telling a lie in the movie.
Yeah.
So they're acting and they're lying, which is two level layers or something, you know?
But
you
I know, do I read, find it chilling like that for some reason. Yeah.
I read two books during the holiday and both of them did that. I read Library at Mount Char, which I can't recommend enough. That was like my whole
shit.
How have I just discovered this? But I also read one called Where They Wait. And it's from a couple of years ago, but the scariest part was like a ship story that they were telling about a shipwreck from 100 years prior, but it was by far the scariest part of the book. And yeah, it's like one layer removed, but it works so well.
Yeah, because you're almost using, it's like the author's letting the character's perception let the reader know what's going on. The same thing, another book that does that great is Peter Straub's Ghost Story. And the book is filled with stories, but the one about, it's basically the riff on Turn of the Screw with I think the character's name is like Fenny Bate or something, but it's the Turn of the Screw story, but it's told through this you know lens of another of storytelling, and for some reason it's just so creepy. And if you look at some of the older the Henry James's Turn of the Screw may actually do this itself. I don't remember off the top of my head, but a lot of those older, like Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol or something like that, these stories were always told by someone about to tell a story. And that's the basis of Ghost Story and, you know, stuff like that. But there is something, I don't know what it is. I did that. You know, I wrote a book called Bone White. For me, and I've heard other readers' reaction with the same thing, for me, the scariest part of that novel is a story that a mother relays to the police officer towards the end of the book about how her son was acting strange right before his death and used to wear these goat, you know.
With the husband, the story about the husband and the son.
Yes, the husband and the son. Yeah. And it really worked, and I realized, and it was me trying to explore that idea of putting a story within a story.
You know what it reminds me of a little? It's like in a movie, you have a horror movie, but often the audience is watching a horror movie, but the character isn't aware they're in a horror scenario. Stuff's just happening to them. But if they do get told a story, or if they suddenly realize the context of what's happening to them, suddenly they're in a horror thing. And it's almost like a switch turns. I read over the break one of the best, you know, I'm sure you would have read this one, but it has exactly this, and I didn't know, I hadn't put my finger on it. Song of Kali by Dan Simmons.
Oh, Dan Simmons,
Of the like older books I caught up to this year, that one was just before I read Senseless, actually, and it's the best scene in it is when the people come and tell him what happened to that poet, you know, who's disappeared, and it's so grotesque and Lovecraftian, but because it's somebody just telling the story, it was one of the most effective horror things I've read.
Was that made into a movie?
No, there's some Kali stuff, but that one hasn't. I was actually asking a friend about that, and I think
oh,
it's
okay.
It's
there's
set in
a
Calcutta.
Movie.
It's really something.
There's a real fucked up cult movie from probably 15 years ago called Tears of
Oh,
Kali.
yeah.
That's
I have heard of that too,
real
yeah.
messed up. That's culty. So
That's
sorry.
a good segue to ask you about movies, because
Yeah.
I'm always interested what movies meant to you when you're young. Like, you're exact same generation as us. Video stores were a massive part of our education in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
How was that for you? How did that feed into kind of what you were excited to write?
Man, I always liked horror movies. And back then, it's like whatever you can get your hands on. I mean, I remember being a kid and going through all of the Friday the 13th movies on VHS. We'd rent them and like do just like a marathon and watch these movies, and we'd rewind all the kill scenes and watch them again. That was a big series. All that kind of 80s, when that whole 80s slasher craze came up, that was like stuff that me and my friends were into. Things with movies, it's kind of it was a fluid thing with me, and it's ever changing. It still
Yeah.
changes now. I went through a period in the 90s where I was like nothing but David Fincher and I must have watched Fight Club a thousand times, and or the Coen brothers,
Yeah.
their stuff. Just you start like appreciating broader things in the stuff you watch. I think some of the best, not to be schmaltzy, man, but like I love the sentimentality of those early Spielberg movies. I think
Yeah.
the ones he directed, the ones he produced, I think they're fantastic. And even for their faults, if you want to call it that, there's something charming about the storytelling and the cinematography and the acting. All of it kind of comes together and just makes like this perfect thing.
Because it's genuine. It's coming from a real
It
place for
is.
him.
It really is. You really get that sense. And especially like, I don't, there's very few movies and stuff that are new that appeal to me. I mean, I'm not on the whole Marvel bandwagon. I mean, these sort of mass produced things for trying to appeal to everyone, as opposed to saying, okay, this is a thriller, or this is a noir piece, or this is a romantic comedy, and this is the section of people that we're going to, try to attract with this type of a movie. Everything is some big tent, $400 million tentpole Hollywood production, and it's like, well, we can put comedy and romance and horror and thriller, and it's a musical too, and if you watch it backwards, Paul's dead. They add all this crap to it, and it's like. You lose me somewhere along the way. And I'm not, look, but clearly I'm not running a studio because they make a gazillion dollars, but
After this episode, watch out. I mean, with horror, it's like a lot of things, we go in cycles, just like our reading taste, but movies even more. Like, there's periods where post 2000, where I was really, after Scream and everything, I just became very uninterested. I love those movies, but then after a while, I was like, all right, I'm good. And horror just hit a period just for me and the age I was at where I just lost interest for a few years. And then, but
Not me.
yeah, well, yeah, you know, but like, I just, I.
I love popcorn movies. Like, they're still my jam, even though I will always kind of gravitate towards the indie stuff. But do go
Well,
on, Corey.
I just mean like sometimes you'll see something. I remember when I picked up Hellraiser for the first time on VHS, and the cover was kind of like, oh shit, should I even watch this? This looks pretty fucking dark. Like, I didn't know if it was gonna cross some line, and because it looked perverse. And then I watched this, and I'm like, oh, horror can do this. I am so in. Like the idea of adult movies can be in this genre and fun and playful. It just is so wide.
I feel like that is what Terrifier is currently doing for a number of for a different generation. Because seeing how the Terrifier franchise is being viewed through like my daughter's eyes, it is how I watched Hellraiser with a this feels unsafe, this feels unhinged. I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about this, but for some reason I'm really enjoying it. And it's that same level. And even though I will say Terrifier is definitely not made for
It's
me,
not as sexy. Terrifier is not quite as sexy.
it's not as sexy as Hellraiser. There's no Julia or skin ripping. There's still lots of skin ripping, but not quite as poetic skin ripping. But I think that it is still doing that whole, this feels unsafe, and there's something I really like about that. But for a completely different generation.
Well, and that's good that each generation should have their own thing like that. And I think, like, Elric, I'm the same with you. Like, yeah, I love the original Scream movie and stuff, but I think the problem with, you have these movies at certain points in history that are so, they turn the tables. They present the genre in a way that we've never seen before. And then what you have after the success of something like that is 1,000 movies ripping it off for the next decade. And that gets tiresome, you know? So that's, for me, that's a good time where I'm like, I do seek out more of the indie stuff. I do seek out some of the older stuff. Yeah. And just kind of go back into it. And there's, you know, I think that's good. I think it's good that, you know, you could always find that, you know, for every Scream ripoff that there was some indie film coming out, and that was like, what, mid-90s, 96-ish, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's always something there to be found.
You know, it's back kind in time, yeah.
Yeah, that's the beauty of horror and what Elric and I talk about on our offshoot podcast of this Deep Cuts, our Patreon show. Mm-hmm. Is that for every, you know, time I go see Long Legs or The Substance or any of these like big releases, I can easily find five more films from the 1990s that for some reason I never saw. Mm-hmm. And then I will go back and I spent my entire holiday watching 90s and 2000s thrillers that I'd never seen before. Oh, I can't wait to talk about Break. What was it? Breakdown? I can't even remember the Kurt Russell one.
I love. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
I had never seen that before, and I just found it. I think you had talked about it a couple of months ago, Elric, and then suddenly just being like, "How the fuck did I miss this?" And it was great. And I love that there is just this breadth, this saturation of genre movies that I can always go back and find something. Like, I consider myself to be like a giallo aficionado, but still there's stuff that I'm missing that I'm still like, well, I never heard about this one. This is crazy.
So, I mean, there's a movie called Death Lays an Egg, for Christ's sake. I mean, we live in a world where there's a movie with that title.
I don't know if it's good, but that was a hell of a watch.
It was
an
interesting. So, it was set at an eggplant.
It was an interesting watch. It was set at an eggplant. Yeah. It was a giallo set at an eggplant. I mean, that's all I needed.
So. There's a movie called Deathbed, the bed. Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty good.
It's great.
Pretty
good. And here's the most geeky thing. So I had watched that movie, and then coincidentally, like maybe 2 months later, I watched the Muppets Haunted Mansion movie. I swear to God, there is a shot in Muppets Haunted Mansion that is spoofing Deathbed, where he lifts up a skeleton hand and it's framed exactly the same.
That's cool.
And me, the geek, is like, I swear to God, somebody on the Muppets is like referencing Deathbed, the bed that eats people. Awesome. So I can only hope. I can only hope that's the case.
Probably the director of Deathbed. The director of Deathbed was doing craft services on
He's now on the Muppets. And they were like, shit, you're the director of Deathbed. And
that would be pretty wild. Actually, that has happened at times. There's always somebody very obscure, and then you look up what they did and you're like, wow, how did you make it from there? I mean, even Peter Jackson can be seen that way, right?
Yeah.
And Sam Raimi, these are guys who are, it's pretty wild. I want to go back to your process a little bit, because like one thing you were just talking about bouncing around, and I love that of the 8 books I read, they weren't really in the same genre. You know, and your newest book, Senseless, to me is like a real tapestry of weaving multiple genres. All I'll say about it, this one comes out, I believe, in April, right? So we don't want to say too much.
Yeah, Senseless comes out.
What's so cool about this, if you had asked me, oh, you've got it right there, the first 40 pages, I felt I knew exactly what kind of book this was, and I was into it. I was like, cool, I'm reading a detective, burnt out detective serial killer book. I'm in, no problem at all. Yeah. And then 100 pages, I'm like, wait, what is this part of the storyline? And then there's another story. And as they go, they're all, you know, super readable. But as it starts to come together, what I liked about it is there is no way you could put this together without continuing reading. You need the whole story. You can't just guesstimate. You're like a detective. You can't just go, I guess I worked this out. You need to finish the story. And I thought that was really, it felt original, felt different than Come With Me, which could have been, it could have just been an offshoot of that. So in terms of a couple of things, a process, like how, you know, if you're writing with outlines or freewheeling, and B, picking that kind of story in the genre, and if you purposely try to push yourself into different kind of spaces.
Yeah. You know, I've been fortunate enough to be able to not get too pigeonholed into writing a particular subgenre of work. You know, I guess if you're a rabid horror reader, you're going to say, well, these books aren't really horror. But if you're just a thriller reader, you're going to go, these books are a little too horror for me. You know, so they walk this kind of ambiguous tightrope of what they actually want to be, which I like. And I didn't do that deliberately. It's just the kind of stuff that I enjoy reading and enjoy writing. I don't outline. I kind of sit and think for a long time about what the book's going to be about, who the characters are, you know, sort of the the idea of what the story is and the flow of it. I sometimes have an idea of the beginning, a little bit of what the end might be like, and everything else is sort of, I don't know, we'll see when we get there. So I approach the writing of these books almost like I'm the first reader. So
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
and that's, I write them in a way that that would appeal to me to keep me engaged
Yeah.
with the story. As far as like how you just what you said about Senseless, what'd I say, 20 novels, I guess, over a career of 25 years doing this. I want to challenge myself. I don't want to write the same thing that's out there. I don't want to be a cover band. I'm writing original stuff, right, man? So it's like, with each book, it's like, how do I tell a story? I did this with Small Town Horror, which came out last year. I'm taking a trope of this of friends with a dark secret in a small town. I use the cliche of that trope as the title of the novel, just to spin it on its head and say, you think you know what this is, but it's not. And I do that really to challenge myself and to put something original out that I feel is out there on something that somebody thinks they understand what it is, that it wears the guise of the familiar, but it adds enough twists and differences to keep everyone off kilter. And I think that's sort of the perfect marriage, is you want that familiarity, or at least the pretense of familiarity when you go into a book or any kind of story, only to have the rug pulled out from under you when you realize this isn't the comfy thing I thought this was going to be, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I try to do that with all the stuff I write.
Well, I also just love what you're saying. I think me and Becca definitely feel this way about filmmaking, which is the you want to make something that you're not seeing right now that you would want to see. What is the kind of movie you want to see? So that's the goal. They're harder to make sometimes because they might not fit as easily into a framework as certain things. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I want to ask this question because I've asked, it's my favorite question to ask writers because I've asked it of like Clay McLeod Chapman, Paul Tremblay, Stephen Graham Jones, all the writers that we've had on the show, Grady, everybody, is how do you catalog your ideas? Because from a writer perspective, I view kind of every blip that pops into my brain is in some way sacred. And I'm going to write it down somewhere. But I found that every writer has kind of a different idea. And then it's the idea of if in a few days that's still kind of there is like a splinter in my brain, then I might start actually like putting something down, but I let it sit for a few days. So how do you categorize or catalog all of your ideas? And then how do you decide when you're going to start moving on something? How do you decide when you're going to be like, you know what, I'll write a paragraph or I'm going to spend the day just writing on it and see how it shakes out?
It used to be that I would fill up what have been dubbed my serial killer notebooks, of nothing but ideas and hastily scribbled in crayon with a weird drawing to go with it. And if I'm ever arrested and they find these books, they're going to put me away for forever. But I would write down everything in those books. I haven't done that in a really long time. So that was the cool, sexy stuff I was doing. Now what I do, honestly, if, I mean, stuff occurs to me, it just kind of sits in my head, and it's there. I don't always consciously think about it, but whenever a story comes, those things sort of pop. I can mine through them. So when I think when I'm thinking of a novel, it comes from a couple of different places. One is primarily it's character. What kind of character do I want to explore, right? And with that, it's usually what scenario best fits this character. What story? I'm not a plot-driven writer, but I am a story-driven writer, and those are a little different. And I try to marry those things up. And if I want to tell a story about, if I've got this character that's just been on my brain for so long, how do I tell it? How do I tell it? And I didn't know what to do. I'll dig through, I'll keep that character on the back burner, and then I may get an idea 3 years later for a story I want to write. And I'm like, what character would live in this world? I'm like, oh, the one I created in my head 3 years ago. I wrote my book Come With Me was similar to that and how it came up. I was reading Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark about the search
Oh,
for the
yeah.
Golden State Killer, and the idea of her as an author writing this story, And researching this stuff on her own appealed to me. I'm like, I'd like to tell a story about that. Like, I'm interested in that character. What would that character do? And I didn't really know what to do with that character, so it sat kind of on the back burner. You jump ahead a little bit, and I had a friend of mine who was a reporter who was killed in a shooting at her office place in the newspaper where she worked. It was a big deal out here. They were on the cover of like Time Life magazine, and it was a nasty thing. But so after she had died, I kind of started thinking of this story from the husband's point of view of what who of the person left behind and what he would think and deal with. And I started just kind of writing out stuff about that story as a way of dealing with that loss, right? Sort of like a grieving process. And it wasn't until I was writing it that I realized that my friend, who's sort of I'm writing this thing to grieve, she's this character that I wanted to play with from a few years earlier, and how I marry those up. That became that novel. So all those pieces are always kind of there. I don't necessarily write them down anywhere. They just kind of live in my head.
Right. And if you didn't give it that space, you wouldn't have all those textures, right? You
Yeah.
forced it out as a story. I mean, that one connected deeply to me. And again, might have been a similar thing when grief's on your mind. That was the first of your books I read, actually. But I was curious, and that might answer it, but I know one of the ones I haven't read yet, I know you might have mentioned, but what's for you, the most personal book you read, where you felt, I mean, all books and everything we make is personal, but was there one that when you're reading it, you're writing it, it's got the most, whether it's hidden autobiography, things like that. Was it that one, or was it the one I'm thinking of with the teenagers that I haven't read yet?
Well, Come With Me was very, Come With Me hit on that while I was writing it, and I kind of knew what it was while I was writing it. The book you're probably talking about is December Park, which is that's my most autobiographical. It's five kids growing up in the 90s. The whole book spans an entire year, and they decide to band together and find this murderer who's killing teenagers in their neighborhood. And it's a coming of age sort of, kids on bikes kind of thing for the early to mid 90s. And I wrote the first draft of that I wrote in high school. And I wrote it because I was writing a ton of different I was going home and typing up all these stories after school, and I wanted my friends to read some. And of course, these knuckleheads don't want to read anything. So I made them all characters in this story
Oh,
in
that's
our
good.
neighborhood. And that's how I got them to read it. And I
I
wrote it.
like that.
And I think, man, I think in high school, I think that manuscript was like 400 pages
Oh,
typed
wow.
out.
Wow.
And I, but it was not, and I even knew it as I got older and was writing more. It wasn't publishable. It was, me kind of learning my craft. But it sat for a long time until I wanted to actually clean it up and publish it, because I really liked the story. I knew what the problems were, and I knew what the fixes were a few years later. And all the fixes for me seemed to work. And that's kind of so that's it's one of my personal favorite books because of all that.
So when you take a book from like an idea or collection of ideas in your head and you say, okay, you know what? I'm going to start on it. Like, what is your step one? Do you sit down and outline? Do you know the beginning and middle and end already? Do you just start writing at page one and go? Do you start at 50 because you already know what happens there? Like, what is the process that you go through?
I think about it for a while, and then I just start at page one and see where I go. I don't outline at all. If I outline too much, it makes me not interested in writing the story because I kind of already know where it goes. What really is my trigger is like if I have the story, I have the characters, I know where I want to go. I sort of have that first scene of how this book should open. Then I wait. And I wait for it's got to be the first two sentences. It's not just the first. It's got to be the first sentence and the second that link together. And I'm like, that's how it starts. That's my opening line. And then the second sentence is how I carry it into the novel. And that's how I sit down. And once I get those, once I have those sentences, I'm kind of off to the races. It goes from there.
Oh, wow. I wish I could do that. My brain does not. Well, I'm the type of writer where I will write page 20 because I know what that scene's going to be. And then I'll write page 55 because I know what that scene is. And then I'll have a collection of scenes. And then I'm writing the connective tissue to take me from scene to
Man, that's
scene.
tough. I get I you're not the I've heard other writers do that too. That's very tough. I've only really done that with one book, which Elric, it was Senseless. I wrote the way that book is built, it lent itself more towards there's
A lot
basically
of
three
connective
separate
tissue
stories.
affecting each
Yeah, that
other.
kind of come together. So for some of that, if I was jammed up on one section, I'm like, well, let me just not sit here and waste time. Let me jump to this other part. Which it's funny because because there's no outline, once I write and I start this process, that in my head is organically how the story is told. So if I were to write out of order, I would think of this story happening out of order. I would think this is, well, wait a minute, that can't happen because this didn't happen first. And that, and
Interesting.
it's kind of weird how I think about it. I also, I never, you write these things, they go through edits. I pull stuff out. My editors, I add stuff in, and then by the time the books are published, I'm so sick of looking at them. So I never really,
Same.
So you never
I
go
mean, I
back and
love them.
look.
They're my babies, but it's like Elric. It's very much like you're going through with the film right now, where you're like, I have been staring at this edit for fucking 8 months and I've agonized over every frame. And you reach a point where you're just like, can it just come out so I can just file this under completed and just call it? So, no, I'm in copy edits on my second one right now. And copy edits to the point where I start getting edgy because I'm like, yep, we've been over all the there's that we can. I get it. I suck at it. And yeah, that's where it becomes kind of agonizing.
Well, I also get to these weird, like midway through that process, I'll have like, I'm like, oh, you know what? I could add this. Or I'll say, this isn't working. Or my editor will say, this doesn't work and pull it out. So sometimes I forget what the final version of the book looks like. Like people talk about a scene. I'm like, oh, I guess that made it into the book. I don't remember if I left that in or okay. But it's
Oh,
funny.
now you talk about having ideas and drawers and stuff. So Senseless is coming out in April, so that's going to be your newest book. But while that's happening, like how many things are you actively writing in a moment like now? Like, are you actively on the own, limiting yourself to write one book at a time, or are you kind of peppering through different things?
Well, I'm on, so I'm like, just because of the timeline of publishing. So Senseless comes out in April. I'm currently writing the novel that comes out after Senseless right now. I'm sort of in the beginning stages of that. I've got about, my publisher likes to call it a year between books. It's like 10 months. They squeeze me. So it's a lot to, and my writing process is generally, if I've got a year to write a novel, I will squander 8 months of that walking around my house, staring at walls, looking outside, cutting the lawn, thinking about it, like just to kind of get my
Oh,
head
so
working. I
you're the character
actually
in
write.
Ghost Ridden. You're the author they talk about who they're worried that the book's not getting written, the screenplay's not happening, and
Somehow,
you're
you know
like,
what? And I do.
there's a beautiful thing for that because I always, in even in college and even now as a writer, I wanted to be that person who was like, I'm going to get my essay done, 5 months ahead of time. I'm going to get my thesis done long before graduation ever completes. And I was always the person who 4 weeks before my thesis, my like 200 page opus that I had to turn in for that was due, that I was like, oh fuck, I should get started on that. And then
You need some
realizing that,
tension.
okay, I got to do 50 pages a day. I need that the anxiousness about it to light the fire. If I think I have 3 years, I'm not going to be nearly as good as if I think I've got 3 weeks. And then I'm going to feel like I have to get it done. I have to have that creativity.
I agree 100%. If I were to ask for an extension, I would just waste that time too, because I need that crunch time to go, okay, show's on, man, and we got to do it. And I write sort of in those few months. I write, really in sort of a marathon. I'll do 25 some whatever pages a day, and pump them out. And I always get in this spot where I'm like, I feel the pressure. I'm never gonna have time to finish this book. My books aren't really short; they're pretty thick books, and I'm like, I'm never. But I keep reminding myself, we've been here with every other. Like, I always think this. I always think this. I thought that with Senseless. Prior to that, I thought it with Small Town Horror. I did. I wrote a book. My book, Black Mouth. I wrote.
It's a good one.
That's almost, what is it? Oh, 450 pages or so. I think I wrote that in 3 months. Had about a 2 week window to before I had to turn it in, and I wasn't happy with it. I knew something was missing, something wasn't working. I gave it to a couple of beta readers, which I generally don't do. And they're like, no, it works. I'm like, nah, you guys are fools. You don't, you're not getting it. You're not getting it. And I realized then what was missing. and I scrapped like the last 150, 200 pages, rewrote like the last third of the novel, you know, in that 2 week window, like, and then had to go back and make sure everything strung together earlier on, you know, it was, but it made it work. And I always try to tell myself, I'm like, look, I'm a very lazy guy by nature. But with this, I try not to say, well, it's good enough. Because I get very obsessive compulsive about, you know, tightening the screws on these things. So
one of your creepiest characters in any of your work is the guy in that who's kind of stalking the characters with the face. It's just a very unsettling character.
So that character, that's hand in hand with what I was saying. Yeah. That character did not exist on that first draft. He existed 2 weeks in the, yeah, I added
big
that
impact. Thing. Yeah. It's,
and really what it occurred to me is, I mean, that book is about the characters in that book. It's about childhood trauma and how it affects you as an adult. And this is something that this character was perpetrating on children all over the place and doing this. And I realized that I did not have a yin to the yang, right? I didn't have, like, I have all my characters who are struggling, but they're generally good people and they were innocent victims. I don't have the character who was manipulated and traumatized and turned terrible.
Right.
And I'm like, that's what this story is missing. Well, and he is, I find him, yeah. I found him pretty chilling myself. I thought it was
it's pretty fucked up. I mean, and that's always a fun thing in certain books that you can be hooked on the emotional story, and then some element, whether it's your Hannibal Lecter or something like that, pops in and makes it kind of unforgettable. It's the thing that we'll walk away with remembering, which is cool. Mm-hmm. This has been great. I'm curious, with Sense, have you ever thought about writing directly for the screen? Obviously, you know, works of yours might be optioned over the time, but have you ever thought about writing in a different lane, basically?
Go in screenplay.
Yeah, I've done screenplays. Mm. I've worked with studios on them. I worked with independent filmmakers. For the astute archaeologist, you could find movies that have been written by me and produced and even directed under a different name.
Oh, nice.
But I have done it. I love the format. I love writing screenplays because it's fun, and it, compared to writing a novel, it's it's quick, and I like the collaboration that goes into making something for the screen, as opposed to writing a novel where I'm just by myself all the time. So I do like, you know, I did a couple of short segments for some friends' anthology films. That was fun. I got to go to on set and watch them shoot it. So that stuff is great. And I used to do it sort of as a palate cleanser when writing books became like a job. I'm like, well, how do I have fun writing still? You know, and I realized that, you know, hey, all it takes is a pen name and 95 pages, give or take, and you could write whatever the hell you want for the screen. You know,
that's true.
So I did a lot of that stuff. I had fun doing that.
For some reason, authors never...
I'd love to do some more.
It never works as well when they adapt their own novels, I find. Like, I feel like they're better to write an original script than try to adapt their own script.
All the stuff I've done have mostly been original stuff or kind of work for hire that, you know, was someone else's kind of input into what I was doing. I did... So before Small Town Horror was a novel, I actually pitched it as an original TV series, and it was optioned by... 20th Century Fox and Disney, and then worked with those folks. So I wrote the pilot script for the it was a TV show is what they were doing before. I wrote the pilot script for that. We had a bunch of meetings, and just like most of these things, they eventually have too many cooks in the kitchen. They fall apart. But I'm like, well, fuck it. I was going to write this as a novel anyway. Might as well do it now. So that's how the book came out of it.
Hey, that's how my comic came out. The comic that I have out now through Dark Horse Barstow was optioned by a network. My husband and I wrote the pilot, and then it fell apart, came back to us, and then we were like, fuck it, let's do it some other form, because we still love the story so much. So yeah, it works. It works.
No, it does. And I mean, look, you want to see these things get made, and that'd be cool, but it's like, you know, it's also that creative drive to see like the stuff that you put all your heart and soul into this stuff. Like, you know, executives they don't care about your characters or how you lay in bed at night going, nah, this guy's, he'd have curly hair. Yeah,
No,
you
no.
really, they don't
He can't.
care.
He's not a dentist. He's a chiropractor. That totally
Exactly.
tracks.
There,
If you get a
right. Now
chance
I can go to
to
sleep.
if you get a chance to watch The Brutalist, which is out now, the director of that, Brady Corbet, is giving some Q and A's. Like every people like us are cheering, and a lot of suits are like getting very upset because he's just going all at them about their
Yeah.
notes, the way they give notes, and it's been pretty amusing. It's like the guy doesn't care if he works again kind of vibe, and he's kind of swinging for the rafters, which is fun.
Oh, Rick, was it you that told me there was a podcast that had the director of The Substance on it? And I can't remember if it was you or if one of my students had me listen to it, but it was the director of The Substance talking about how it was originally with a studio and that the
Yeah.
studio was
Oh, it's
giving her
Paramount.
all
Yeah,
of
it's gonna
these
be
notes.
Paramount, I think.
Yeah, it was Paramount, and they were giving her all of these notes about we need to make this more commercial. We can't do this. And she ended up just being like, peace, y'all. I'm gonna go make it on my own and took it to MUBI. But that there was this drastically different version of The Substance where she had been heavily censored. There was
Well,
no
but that said,
gore. It
like if
was,
I'm
yeah.
Paramount or 20th Century Fox, I probably, if I was an exec there and not you knowing my taste, I still probably
I
wouldn't have
get
made
it.
that. Yeah, I probably wouldn't have been able to see how it could have become a hit because it is so
No.
different than what they do. But it's so cool that it's become a hit. Like it's
Yeah.
amazing to think of that. Something
Sure.
so wild. So, well, it's funny, your work you were talking about in your 20s to wrap up, you're saying in 20s or 30s, early 30s, a lot of Fincher. There's some Fincher DNA in The Senseless, so
Oh my gosh, yeah.
you know, there's even just the
Yeah.
geography of it in a good, in a way that to me is, that's a real good thing because I
Yeah.
find, you know, watching his movies, he's a perfectionist, obviously, the way he approaches things, and there's just these details in this that got me really, just, you know, fascinated, and I found it to be kind of like the way Come With Me was really mesmerizing the first time I read it, and this was, and then also removed me at times, and then pulled me back in a way that I thought was really kind of exciting and different. So, you know, obviously we're plugging this a little bit before, but you know, I don't know
Yes,
where
but
what's the publishing company?
this one,
Titan,
Titan.
Titan.
Yeah. And I will read LA Noir till the end of
Yeah.
days. So, which it seems like it right now in LA. So, hey, it's fitting right
Oh,
now.
yeah, that's
So,
great. And I knew I visited LA, but I have never lived there. And when I first thought of this book, I'm like, it's got to be in that. This is what I'm saying. When your ideas come together, it's like it's demanding to be in Los Angeles. I don't really know enough to, most of my books are in Maryland, where I live. And but I'm like, I could cheapen out and write it in a location that I know, but doesn't have the flavor, right? Doesn't have the flavor. So I leaned heavily on my friend, who's writer Philip Fricassi, who lives out there. And
Loved Boys in the Valley was
Boys in the Valley,
amazing.
yeah,
Yep.
it's fantastic. All his work is great, and he's the best guy, man. But I said, hey, look, would you care if I just said, look, you know, I need to know like a street or the kind of house this person would live in and where that would be in the city. And man, he sent me emails and pit photos and map detailed maps.
That's
And
cool.
it was fantastic. So, yeah, I'm a little indebted to him on that, but, and I said, look, when you read the book and if I screwed anything up, don't tell me, it's done. So I don't want to know.
That's fair.
Well,
Yeah,
thank
it's great.
you so much for joining us tonight. Senseless comes out. I know it's April. Is there a specific date?
April 15th, maybe, I think.
I feel like it would be on this book that April 15th,
There it is.
But there's so
2025.
many
So
other books you can discover early. If,
so many.
if that's
I
true.
mean, because like me, what I was getting at is I hadn't discovered your work till this year. So it's not like your name wasn't familiar to me, and then, but also I hadn't been reading a lot lately, and so it was kind of just cool when these things time and you just throw yourself into a new writer. So it's very,
Yeah.
very cool. Congrats on this
Well, I
book.
appreciate that.
Yeah, no,
Thank you.
it's been
Yes,
a
thank
great
you.
year.
And thanks for having me on.
Yeah,
This is great.
no worries.
Thank
Very
you.
cool.
And thank you guys so much for joining us tonight on Colors of the Dark. And please check out our Patreon show, Deep Cuts, where we will be diving into some sweet Giallo January, as well as a lot of other weird shit that we watched during the holidays. Elric's got some catching up to do because he's been traveling so much.
I
So,
had to
yeah, he's
purity
going to.
17 days without a movie. I purified my soul.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. I can't even. I can't even. I watched so much over the break. I have so much weird shit to talk
right, well,
about.
good.
So you can catch us over there. And thank you all so much. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a interview with a brand new director and a great new film that's coming out. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.